This is David Astle on ABC Radio.
Well, you'd hate to be only you if you were suddenly in the crosshairs of a criminal matter. You'd need to have a very shrewd lawyer at your elbow. And Rob Stary would be certainly one that you would look up if you had had the wherewithal. Rob Stary is the founder and partner of Stary, Norton, Halfen Criminal Lawyers, and is also an LIV accredited specialist in criminal law. And we have been hunting you down, Rob, for quite a few months. It's great to have you on board.
And that's a very kind introduction. Thank you very much.
We've kind of almost taken you out of the from the garden, I understand, today.
Well, the garden is my great escape. It's my therapy, really. And but having heard Dr. Nick, I'm just a little bit more apprehensive, starting to scratch and squirm.
So just to remember to wear those gloves, mosquito repellent, long sleeves, okay?
I'm going to the GP tomorrow just to report whatever there's wrong.
Any mosquito bite suddenly under a profound suspicion. Yeah. But quite seriously, I'd imagine that the area of criminal law, it can be take its toll, mental toll and a physical toll. How long has gardening been a refuge for you, Rob?
Well, firstly, I've been practicing for 40 years. Mm. 40 years in April next year, and I've been interested in the garden really all my life, actually. And so I've got a couple of acres not far from Melbourne. I go up there, plant trees, look at the trees, watch the birds, listen to the birds. And I enjoy it. And as I said, that's my escape.
I think we've just discovered the secret to your 40 years right there. It must be a very important outlet.
Yeah, it is.
Now, there's so many bases that we could cover. In fact, we had Bill O'Shea in recently talking about the how the forensic evidence, for one starter, has been examined quite closely under review. And it seems as though forensic evidence is now kind of worthy of more questioning, particularly in non-DNA aspects.
That's right. I think the president of the Court of Appeal actually challenged practitioners and the legal fraternity to really have a close look at expert evidence. We know DNA is probably reliable, and we know that DNA juries almost always accept that sort of evidence. But there are other forms of forensic evidence that come into question. Gunshot residue, and you'll remember the famous accused in Canberra, David Eastman, who said to have shot Colin Winchester, relied on gunshot residue prosecution to convict him, spent 19 years in jail, and ultimately that was discredited. And so the president of the Court of Appeal said, well, we've got to really be a bit more diligent in examining that sort of evidence. Bite marks is another one. So everything really other than DNA has now come under much closer scrutiny.
Hair samples too, I seem to recall.
Yeah, that's
list
correct.
That Bill brought up.
Is this one of those areas that's a bit difficult? I mean, have we gotten to this place in part because most lawyers are not also scientists?
Yeah, look, I think, and I think the other change that I've noticed over the last 40 years is that more accused people are aware of their rights, particularly their right against self-incrimination. They're much more inclined to make no comment records of interview, which means that prosecution cannot rely on confessions as they once did. And so there's a greater reliance on forensic evidence, particularly. And we're not good scientists. You're right about that. And we don't have the resources. If a case is legally aided, we're lucky to get a bare bones defence. Prosecution seems to be much better resourced, and so there's not the scrutiny or the examination of that evidence that there should be. And I talked about David Eastman in Canberra. He spent 19 years in jail. That's just one example. I acted for another woman who was a teacher, said to have sexually assaulted two of her pupils. And it was calling out for a proper examination. I won't go into the detail, but proper examination of the evidence was found wanting. She spent 2.5 years on remand for a crime that she never committed. She's a 60-year-old woman, so it's pretty tough.
How much of this stuff is sort of being studied by, say, universities or, scientists in universities who have, the skill sets and the methodologies to actually be analysing these scientific sort of questions? And how much is it being left to lawyers to sort of essentially, you know, scrutinise the scientific mm-hmm. method in the courtroom?
Well, I think you're right about one thing, that the tertiary institutions are critically important. So we're much more reliant on those than we certainly previously did. But we do need to have the skills and the additional support to understand the science, and so that the jury can understand the science. When jury hears scientific evidence, they usually think it's sacrosanct. They accept it, it's not always foolproof. And so what we all want to do is make sure that injustices do not occur and people aren't wrongly convicted.
I would imagine one of the biggest challenges in the last 10 years in the legal profession, in criminal law in particular, is finding a jury who is not aware of a particular case or doesn't have access or the temptation to find out more about that case, finding essentially an impartial, unprejudiced jury. How can we ensure as best we can to get a jury with an impartial approach?
Well, David, it's a topical area because juries are now not identified by name but rather by their number. The number of challenges to any prospective juror have been reduced previously from 12. You traditionally, in a criminal law case, have 12 people on a jury. You used to have 12 challenges. Now that's been reduced to 3. So the opportunity to challenge people are more limited. You generally don't know what their occupation is. So if you've got someone charged, for instance, with an armed robbery of a bank, and you don't know that one of the prospective jurors is a bank teller, that can cause problems. And we're moving now to a position, I think the current attorney, Jill Hennessy, is talking about having an election where you can have a trial by judge alone. And I didn't think this had ever happened in my career, but I think it will come to fruition. I think we'll have judge-alone trials. And the other thing, of course, that's happened, of course, is the internet.
And is it just about the jury potentially seeing things on social media or the internet that might affect their ability to bring an impartial mind, or are there other sort of considerations that mean that we've reached this point that judge-only trials might actually become a thing in Victoria?
Yeah, look, it's a complex issue. We know that conviction rates, for instance, have increased, where evidence is presented really in the same format. Sexual assault trials is the best example. Social mores have changed, and we know that the conviction rate has increased from around 27 or 28% to now over 75%. So there's a massive increase in the conviction rates. That's because, as I said, there's a change in social mores. It's not because we're more reliant on scientific evidence or DNA evidence. It's often oath on oath. Complainant says something, the accused says something else, and yet jurors are much more inclined to convict. So there are changes that are occurring. Things that we regarded as the fundamental cornerstones of our justice system have changed and have eroded: presumption of innocence, the burden of proof, the right to silence, the right against self-incrimination. They're all fundamentally important rights that have all just been incrementally eroded over many years.
Rob, I'm interested, you say you've been doing this for 40 years. You've talked about some of the changes that we're all familiar with, but social media, the internet, that sort of thing. I'm interested, though, I wonder how much has actually stayed the same, because in the end, your job is about people. It's about talking to people. It's trying to extract truth and raise doubt where it's appropriate. Is that just actually stayed the same in 40 years?
Good question.
Well, we have I say now we only have a notional presumption of innocence. If you're charged with a sexual assault of a child, I would say that most people would assume, whilst you're standing in the dock, in the back of the court, flanked by two prison officers, jury comes in, here's the allegation, you'll be starting off with no presumption of innocence, but rather they will assume you're guilty.
Was that not always the case, though?
Well, I think things have changed culturally. I think that's one thing that's occurred. And proliferation of different social platforms, internet, television, I think things are changing.
But Rob, how can we? That you, what you're painting ultimately is this kind of slow erosion of the right to a fair trial. Yeah. How can we safeguard or even start to reverse this tide of towards more of a conviction culture?
Yeah, well, it's probably true that the pendulum had swung heavily in favour of accused people when I had started work. The prosecution's obligation to prove a case beyond reasonable doubt, they're the words that are used, actually meant something. But now it seems that the correction that was required has corrected too far. And we are now getting instances of people who, as I said, David Eastman is but one graphic example, spent a long time in jail. Lindy Chamberlain's another more obvious example. People who should never have been incarcerated. But there are many, many others. We've got record numbers of people in jail. We've got, I'll just say this, the serious crime rate has either remained static or fallen over the last 12 years, and yet our prison population has trebled in that same period.
David Astle here on Writs and Cures. Our special guest tonight is Rob Starry, who's the founder and partner of Starry, Norton, Halfen, criminal lawyers. Co-hosts here as well being Katie Miller, Melbourne lawyer, and Dr. Nick Carr, a Melbourne GP. You've also been involved in some pretty heavy cases, I'm going to have to say, Rob, from murder to sexual assault to terrorism included.
Yeah.
Do you seek these cases out, or do they find you?
Well, it's funny you say that. I think we've developed a niche market for some reason in terrorism. I think it started with the famous Jack Thomas case, Jihad Jack as he was known, 2004 when he was repatriated from Afghanistan. And having acted for Jack, his family were the sort of quintessential suburban family. Dad was a teacher. Mum was a suburban housewife. And Jack was a convert to Islam and had gone to Afghanistan. And ultimately he was acquitted of any offence of either being a member of a terrorist organisation or fostering or nurturing a terrorist act. And things started to flow from there. Fortunately, we're interdenominational because although we've acted for all the Islamists, still the jihadists, we've also acted for the Tamil Tigers and we've acted for the Kurdish people recently. Who are now, curiously, even though the Kurdistan Workers' Party is a proscribed organisation in Australia, they were allies of the West in the fight against ISIS, as you all know. And we've acted for the Kurdish community. So we've acted for people across the board and in a sense, developed. We've had a fantastic team of people at work who've developed those skills and that expertise. And then I was saying to Dr. Nick and Katie outside that in the gangland wars, we acted for effectively people who were from the western suburbs. That was our base, and so that included people like Carl Williams and Tony Mockbell.
Has this brought jeopardy upon your practice at any point?
Not really. We've got a job to do. This is how we rationalise it. We're defence lawyers. That's our role in the system. We don't subscribe to anyone's ideology, as I said before. We defend people vigorously. We believe in the rule of law and we believe in those fundamental cornerstones. We don't prosecute people. We don't judge them. And we certainly don't impose any penalty. Our role is simply to defend people. And if we do that fairly and if we do that robustly, then we're doing our job.
With something like terrorism, which, I'm imagining that when you started out 40 years ago, terrorism wasn't quite as prominent in practice as it is now. I mean, how do you go about defending someone on terrorism charges? How is that different or similar to defending people for more sort of, dare I say, garden variety criminal offences?
Well, terrorism charges are an unusual beast because those persons who are charged with offences are usually charged preemptively. They're usually charged with planning or nurturing a terrorist act. They don't wait for an act to occur. And it usually comes as a result of mostly young men getting together and talking about things and planning engage in sometimes what might be a catastrophic event. But with the advancement of technology, we know that that chatter is monitored. There are words that trigger when phones are monitored. Certain words trigger intervention, and then people are usually monitored over a long period of time. It's not planning one event on Monday and being arrested on Friday. It's usually over a period of months.
Katie Miller, Melbourne lawyer, and Dr. Nick Carr are my co-hosts for the Writs and Cures segment. Happens every Tuesday, 8 to 9. And our guest tonight is Rob Starry, who heads up and is the founder of Starry, Norton, Halfen Criminal Lawyers. We've been covering a lot of ground, Rob, talking about areas of criminal law. One thing that we didn't touch on, of course, is that that area of where you have a kind of strong sense with some clients that, in fact, they may be culpable of the offence that they've been accused of. Where are your grounds sort of morally and professionally in that regard as a defence lawyer?
Well, we often say as criminal lawyers we've got to be squeakier clean than any other lawyer, and so that if someone either says they're guilty or if the evidence is overwhelming, we then say then we are duty-bound for you to enter that plea of guilty. And if they won't take our advice, then we don't act for them. We refer them. But having said that, 90% of all people who face criminal proceedings actually plead guilty. And a lot of the argument is about identifying what the right charge might be, murder or manslaughter or some other lesser charge. And they're the sorts of things that we're mostly confronted with.
Has that shifted in the 40 years that you've been involved in criminal law?
I think the conviction rates are much higher. In the magistrates' court, for instance, it's over 90%. Mm. So there's only a very small percentage of cases that actually run to trial.
There must be some people, though, who don't tell you they've done it, but you've been talking to them, looking in the eye, and you're pretty damn sure, and I got them off. Does that happen often, and how do you feel about that?
No, it doesn't. I can honestly say it doesn't. If we think a person's guilty and the evidence is overwhelming, we're going to use all our powers of persuasion to say you're doing yourself an injustice. If you run a trial, you put the state to the expense of running a trial, you put the victim through the trauma of having to give evidence, then you'll be punished much more harshly. So we do them a disservice unless we get them to acknowledge their wrongdoing, take responsibility for their conduct. So I think that's the skill of a good lawyer, is to say, well, it's pointless running a futile defence. It'll really backfire on you.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that, Rob, because I've often thought that one of the hidden talents that lawyers have, that there's no TV show made about it, is actually the art of persuasion in respect of your own client. Yeah. You know, people think that lawyers like to go and argue with, you know, the other side or with the judge, but a lot of the time, the most powerful and significant act of persuasion you can do is with your own client.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah,
yeah. I think that's right. And the other thing I might say is that if you run a futile case that has no prospect of winning, you'll damage your professional credibility, and that'll have consequences for you. So we're very conscious of that. We don't tell our clients they have to plead guilty. We present the evidence to them. We make recommendations to them. But ultimately, it's their decision. We act on their instructions with this one proviso. We make the forensic judgment about whether they should be pleading guilty or not guilty, and then they either accept that or reject it.
So your memoirs, which must be only a matter of years away, Rob, certainly one chapter would have to be all about your Julian Assange representation. What are your clearest memories of that?
I only acted for him initially when the... When Chelsea Manning had taken those secret files, and curiously at that time we did contact the Australian government and we said, look, let's enter some discussion about what might happen to Chelsea Manning if the files were returned to you. They just didn't even acknowledge our correspondence. Whereas we wrote to the State Department in the US and they were more than happy to talk to us. But as things transpired, of course, she was arrested and then Assange went to the UK. And then he engaged Jeffrey Robinson and other people once he was there.
There is a memoir coming out, is there? You didn't deny that.
There's no memoir.
But, you've given plenty of good advice already. Anything else that you'd like to add for budding criminal lawyers that are considering this aspect or this area of the law?
Oh, look, I think in criminal law, more than anything, you've got to maintain your professional integrity. If you cut corners or if you say things that are not just untruthful, but if you gild the lily, you'll be found out. And so you've got to, you really have to preserve your good reputation, more so in criminal law than anywhere else, I think.
The other area that has been of concern, I know for you as well as many in this building, I'll be honest, is the right to know and how that the freedom of the press is maybe one sacred institution, but there are many other freedoms and safeguards that we need to consider as well.
Well, freedom of the press is critical for every functioning democracy. And so there should be proper transparency and accountability and the government and its agencies should be under the lens really all the time. But that's only one part of the equation. There are other fundamental freedoms that we don't have enshrined, freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, that they have in every other Bill of Rights or Human Rights Act that they might have in the UK or in the European Union. We don't have those legislative enshrined rights. It's the one thing that's missing from the Australian democratic landscape, really, and it needs to be addressed.
We've touched on this before, Katie. In fact, it was a lead story we had about a month ago, the kind of vacuum that in Australian democracy, lack of Bill of Rights.
Absolutely. In fact, we are the only common law country in the world not to have a Bill of Rights. So anytime you hear arguments about what happens in other countries, those arguments need to be heard, understanding that they have Bills of Rights and we do not. And Rob, I mean, when you were mentioning a number of very fundamental rights in the criminal trial process, and you were sort of suggesting that they had also sort of been watered down or diminished over the years. Of course, they're not protected by a sort of constitutional or sort of overarching Bill of Rights.
Well, we have a state charter of rights and responsibilities, and we've got to thank Rob Hulls for that because he really went out on a limb and it's been adopted in other states in South Australia and Tasmania and the ACT. But a national Bill of Rights, I mean, when you look at the UK, for instance, it's the home of the common law, but they have a Human Rights Act. And John Howard famously said, we should trust in the supremacy of Parliament. And I'm afraid I'm not one of those people that puts complete faith in the Parliament.
Now, Rob, I've got to ask you, you cannot get away from this studio, particularly with Katie at your elbow.
Yes.
The name of your, the strap line for your Twitter handle is I don't judge, I don't prosecute, I defend.
Yes.
The image across the top of some beautiful blue flowers surrounded by kind of heath. But I've got your Twitter handle, Rob Bulldog. Don't tell me you're another one of these from the mighty West. What's the connection? We've got Peter Gordon, we've got Katie Miller, and now your good self. There seems to be a bit of a bulldog syndicate in the law.
That's true, and I won't hear a word of criticism. we're champions of truth and justice. So that's the one thing we've got in common.
What.
And lots of integrity.
Yeah, you've got a flag, but you've got a whole lot of propaganda on your side as well. So is it knee high?
Grew up 200 metres from the ground. I grew up in Footscray. So.
All right, totally forgiven.
Yeah.
And as a man of the plants, we are talking roses. How are your roses growing? You got decent roses?
Well, I've got a water-dependent European garden, which is full of Japanese maples and rhododendrons and camellias. And if I planted it 30 years ago, if I was starting again, I'd have a complete native garden that wasn't water dependent.
I have to commend you, Rob, because we've been talking a lot in other forums about the role of green therapy, about the psychological benefits of being out in nature, of hiking and that sort of thing, and gardening. And you started this yourself 30 years ago.
I
did. You found it before the psychologists.
That's right.
Well done.
So Last question, Rob. Is it, kind of as a wrap, what's one thing that you'd love to see accomplished in your own career before you take full-time honours in the garden?
Well, I hope that I will leave the criminal law as someone who's acted with integrity. I hope my peers would judge me in that way.
I've heard nothing else, but it's been wonderful to talk with you, Rob, and I'm so glad that we've finally got you into the studio through the studio doors. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Starry, founder and partner of Starry, Norton, Halfen, criminal lawyers, and LIV accredited specialist in criminal law.